A generation of people has now grown up in Oregon knowing that the state law allows terminally ill people to get prescriptions for drugs to kill themselves. The law allowing assisted suicide or death with dignity or physician-aided dying, pick your term, passed in an election in 1997, and it survived legal and ballot challenges since that time. Not only that, but the concept of physician-aided dying has spread to more states, including California, just last year. A recent study takes a look at the first 18 years of use of Oregon's death with dignity law. The lead author is Dr. Charles Blanke, who is a professor of medicine at the Knight Cancer Institute at Oregon Health and Science University, also obviously known as OHSU. He's also the chair of SWOG, a network of physician researchers conducting cancer clinical trials. We'll talk more about SWOG in just a bit, but Dr. Blanke, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
My pleasure, Jeffrey. Thank you so much for having me.
So this is publicly available data, and I have seen some news stories about it over the years. Does it surprise you that there's been no medical study like this before, or has there been?
Well, to be fair, there has been. The state itself does put out this annual report, and they have analyzed the data. They tended to put out their papers the first 5 or so years after it passed, and then there's been a bit of a quiet period. So we wanted to reassess it as it was approaching its 20th anniversary.
All right. And, of course, the report is called Characterizing 18 Years of the Death with Dignity Act in Oregon. There's a mention in here of a request for additional information from the Oregon Health Authority. What else did you seek, and did you get it?
We did. They were very friendly, helpful, and professional. We were interested in information that wasn't on the website, specifically how many different physicians had written prescriptions and what the average number of prescriptions per physician participating was.
And what did you find out there?
We found that more than 300 physicians actually have taken part. Some of them wrote as few as one prescription and then never wrote another one. And then one physician had actually written 71 prescriptions over the life of the act.
So let's get into what the physicians are mandated to do and are allowed to do or not to do under the act. I mean, do they have to provide a prescription if somebody asks for one?
No, they absolutely do not. And moreover, not only do they not have to provide it, if they're not believers, they don't even have to refer the patient to another physician who does.
Okay. So we've been talking about the physicians thus far, but let's talk about the usage of the laws. With 18 years of data, what is the general trend in the use of the assisted suicide law in Oregon?
So the number of prescriptions written and the number taken has increased pretty steadily over that period, with a very large jump over the last 2 years or so. That's pretty much the trend.
Okay. So, and is there anything that accounts for that increase in the last 2 years?
Well, I think, as you already pointed out, it's becoming more accepted across the United States, with 6 states now making it legal, as well as Washington, D.C. I think patients think of it less as suicide and more as a natural death, so there's less of a stigma. And, of course, there have been some famous cases that are raising awareness, like Brittany Maynard.
I was going to ask if Brittany Maynard had something to do with that. Brittany Maynard was the young woman who was, what, 29 when she came to Oregon from California? She moved here so she could use the law?
She did. She had brain cancer, and she specifically came here because California at the time did not allow physician-aided dying.
And so give us a sense of what discussions go on to this day in the medical community. I can imagine there was a bit of a pitched battle in the days when the law first came into effect in Oregon, effective in, what, 1998. And is it still an object for discussion, or is it more or less considered settled law and settled practice among physicians in Oregon?
No, you yourself already alluded to the early court battles, and those seem to have quieted down. But I think the medical community, there are basically people who still oppose it, particularly those who are in the palliative care field. Some feel if we take care of whatever is bothering the patient at end of life, they won't use this option.
Expand on that a little bit.
Sure. So I think you know that we found the patients using this have issues that we personally felt you couldn't easily relieve. They felt they lost control over their disease or even their life. They felt they lost dignity. And they had some pretty good reasons. But there's still a fraction of people, about 25%, who had inadequate pain control and were actually taking their life as a result. 3% of patients, extremely upsetting, were using death with dignity because they couldn't afford their treatment. So certainly the naysayers do have a little bit of a fodder for their arguments against death with dignity.
All right, so 25% inadequate pain control and 3% couldn't afford to have the care?
Exactly right.
Okay, so again, we're talking to Dr. Charles Blanke at Oregon Health and Science University, where he's a professor of medicine at the Knight Cancer Institute. We're talking about Oregon's death with dignity or assisted suicide law. Your term is your choice. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I've always been fascinated by the gap in numbers, though, between people who get prescriptions and people who use prescriptions. How big a gap is that?
So when we published over the life of the Act, about 60% of patients who get prescriptions take it. And so you can see it the other way, which is about 40% do not. The range has actually been a low of 44 or so percent to as high as 80%. But again, about two-thirds or so do, which also, of course, means a third are not taking it. And you're right, we're very, very interested in the reasons that patients would go to all this trouble. And it is a lot of work. There are a lot of hoops that you have to jump through to get an actual prescription and then not take it.
There have to be a couple of things present in your diagnosis, and then what's the process with the physician, too, and getting the prescription?
So that's exactly right. First of all, the patient has to have a disease that will otherwise take their life. That is a fatal disease expected to be fatal within 6 months. The patient actually has some built-in cooling-off periods. They have to make two verbal requests to the prescribing physician no less than 15 days apart, and they have to make a written request that is witnessed by two people, one of whom is not a family member or loved one or employee of the physician's practice.
And so there's a really limited window, it would seem, here in which a person is aware of the fact that they have a terminal condition and is still sound enough of mind and body to be able to make these requests.
That's exactly right. And not only do they have to be well enough to make the request, they have to be fit enough mentally and physically to self-administer the medication. And believe it or not, that's more of a problem than you might imagine.
In what sense? How is it more of a problem?
Well, for one thing, the most common formulation of the medication comes as 100 sleeping pills. But if you take them the way that they're originally intended for sleep and just pop the pill, you actually can't get 100 down before you fall asleep and get less than a lethal dose. So you have to empty out 100 pills into a glass of water, which does require a lot of dexterity. It actually takes about 45 minutes. Then they have to be able to hold the glass, and they have to be able to swallow, again, relatively quickly. They have to get this medicine down within a minute or two, or the danger is they'll fall asleep, get a less than fatal dose, and wake up. Now, we see people with things like Lou Gehrig's disease who actually can't hold a glass very easily, and it's a big problem for them. And sometimes our cancer patients, believe it or not, within that 2 weeks or whatever the period is, become more ill from their underlying disease, and they just can't manage the drug.
Does this account, then, you think, for a lot of the people who get the prescription and then don't use it?
I do think it accounts for some of them, but I think probably a larger fraction, and this is something we have to look into more, like the control that having the prescription gives them. I've had them tell me they put it in their sock drawer, they haul it out every once in a while and look at it and touch the bottle and know that they could take their life if they needed to if they were suffering, but they never need to. They just want that actual autonomy.
All right, so just knowing that they have the tool there just makes a difference in peace of mind for them, it sounds like.
Exactly right.
Does a profile emerge of who is most likely to use the law in Oregon, demographics, anything like that?
You know, we did have a wide range, but a couple things emerged. Most of the patients are Caucasian. Most of the patients are moderately elderly with an average age of 71 or so. And interestingly, the vast majority of patients are college educated.
Okay, so Caucasian, 71, and college educated. Well, so what do you see in this that might respond or not to the original critics of the law who said this is just going to be a way to make sure that we bump off the people who are becoming a burden to society?
So that's a wonderful question. I don't see any evidence that this is being forced upon the disadvantaged, either the people who are impoverished or are poorly educated. I don't think there's been any slippage, any slippery slope over that 18 years.
All right, that aside, anecdotally, is this something that has become just a part of the suite of options that doctors in Oregon have to offer patients?
Well, medically and legally, the answer is yes, but you already asked me a wonderful question, which is, do physicians have to participate? And unfortunately, I myself have come across patients whose doctors didn't want to do it, didn't want to refer them, and said, good luck finding somebody. And it turns out, despite that 300 physicians I told you about who prescribe, sometimes it takes patients several months to find somebody who will actually do it.
Okay, so another way that the timeline lengthens for people who don't have a lot of time.
That's exactly right. If you have 6 months to live and it takes you 4 months to find a physician, that's a big problem.
All right, so when we talk about 300-plus doctors who do offer the prescriptions or have over the years, I mean, how many doctors are there in Oregon? Is this a large percentage, small percentage?
You know, it's a relatively small percentage. I think more what we're seeing is doctors who believe in the act but aren't comfortable writing the prescription.
Oh, interesting. So is this something that gets discussed a lot when medical people get together for conventions and conferences and that sort of thing?
Absolutely. It's a very hot topic.
Even to this day?
Even to this day, despite the fact that it's approaching its 20th anniversary.
So, Dr. Blanke, when you pull this information together, what kind of picture were you hoping would emerge, and what picture did emerge, whether or not it conformed to the original suspicions?
Well, we were interested, of course, in how quickly physician aid in dying was spreading across the U.S., but as you and I already talked about, we realized there were a lot of questions we didn't have the answers to. Who's using it? What percentage of patients are actually get a prescription and don't take it? Are the drugs actually effective? So those were sort of the questions we wanted to answer. We did a pretty simple data review, but going forward, I think we want to do a more active sort of research program. We want to figure out why, for example, why some of the patients stay asleep, that is, in a coma for a long period before they die, which is not unpleasant for the patients, but is very unpleasant for the family. And it would be nice to be able to warn the family that this type of patient might be in that situation.
It's interesting when you describe the procedure. We have talked about this before and have talked about people who made documentaries about and just seen the whole process of crushing the sleeping pills or the capsules into a glass of water, having to drink the whole thing down in a hurry. And I just wonder who would be in a position to say, you know, there might be a bit more effective way of doing this, but then you end up with this whole realm of places where people feel uncomfortable even taking up the subject.
Well, that's a wonderful question. So let's just compare it to Canada for a second. Canada also has pills available, but they also allow the choice of an intravenous medication given by the doctor. And 100% of patients in Canada essentially pick the intravenous form. Nobody wants the pills. So if we had that option available in Oregon, number one, everybody would use it. Number two, it would eliminate the problems we talked about, which is the patient becomes too ill to take those pills.
But that is not legal. The IV is just not available or legal under Oregon's law?
That's exactly right. Certainly, it's those practicing don't feel that it's legal, and nobody really wants to test the system. It does actually say that the physician himself cannot administer a lethal medication IV, and you've already touched upon this. It would change things from physician-aided dying to some people thinking of this as euthanasia.
All right, the Kevorkian system that got talked about so much many years ago when Dr. Kevorkian was still doing his work.
Right. Even then, as you may recall, the patient had to sort of turn on the death machine himself, so there were some similarities, but it was different as well from Oregon law.
Dr. Charles Blanke is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, which has been in effect since 1998, and he was one of the three authors of a study called Characterizing 18 Years of the Death with Dignity Act in Oregon, working with information provided by the Oregon Health Authority. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about assisted suicide, death with dignity, physician-aided dying, whichever term you choose. We're having the same discussion. 800-838-3760 to join in by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Curiosity here, which goes beyond the numbers, does this conversation ever, can it be, even under the law, be initiated by a physician?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I know from polling and lecturing about this that most physicians do not proactively bring it up. They certainly could. It's a medically legal option, and it's perfectly valid. But I think most physicians are actually worried about the repercussions or the impression that they're pushing it on the patient. So most of us are much more passive, to be honest.
Let me go very broad for a second, though, even outside the realm of physician-aided dying, because I wonder about this in the context of abortion laws and things like that, where you've got gag laws in effect in some states now, where physicians either can tell people nothing or they can tell them things that aren't true. And I just wonder what the general reaction in the medical community is to that.
Again, I think the biggest question is the issue of whether or not there's an ethical obligation to refer a patient if you yourself don't believe in death with dignity. I, of course, do believe the physician should refer. It's legal. It's a medically strong option. But again, many physicians just wash their hands and wish the patients the best of luck.
Okay, let's come back to physician-aided dying a little more squarely then, because when we look at the rate of death by this method versus other causes of death, I mean, one of the claims made again at the beginning of this back in 1997 with the vote was that the law would start a stampede of people asking for prescriptions. But what is the truth about the rate of death versus other causes of death?
It's incredibly tiny. Physician-aided dying makes up less than 0.5% of Oregon resident deaths. So it's an important option. We already talked about it's important out of proportion to the patients using it because many know it's available and that gives them comfort. But if you actually look, despite the increase in patients using this, it's a tiny, tiny fraction of Oregon deaths, and it's not a stampede.
And I notice here among the facts and figures that cancer is the most common underlying disease. I don't suppose that's a surprise of any kind. How common, though?
It's about 77% of patients, that is, 77% of patients have cancer. About 8% have neurologic diseases like Lou Gehrig's disease. And then we see a smattering of patients with underlying heart disease or lung disease that's expected to be fatal. And we even see about 1% of patients who have HIV or AIDS.
Wow. So 77%, number two, is not even close.
Not even close.
Okay. So your work is about cancer. Obviously, you work at the Knight Cancer Institute. And I wonder how this study then illuminates the work you're doing, either your own particular work or the work of the Cancer Institute more broadly.
So I do specialize in end-of-life care. We talked a little bit about patients using this having some concerns that we can't easily get rid of. If people are very, very ill, lying in bed all day, can't read, can't watch TV, can't interact with their family, it's hard to make that better. But we've also suggested that there are things we can fix, such as inadequate pain control, et cetera. So I think that we can help patients without having to offer death with dignity.
Any discussions within the medical community about what might be ethical in terms of expansion of the law? I'm actually a little surprised one of our regular callers hasn't called in. Because his regular concern is about getting to the point where he, as he puts it, is in diapers and drooling, and therefore is not in a state of mind to be able to use the assisted suicide law.
Right. So we already talked about what happens if patients are physically too weak to take it. Why can't we offer an IV formulation? The other big concern is those who expect to have mental decline, for example, patients with Alzheimer's disease. If they have to know what they're doing when they take the pill, I'm actually worried they might take it too soon while they're still mentally competent and thus miss out on some active, enjoyable life. And that's an area that some have suggested the law should change, but others are worried about the slippery slope.
All right, so back to the stuff in front of us, characterizing 18 years of the Death with Dignity Act in Oregon. Were there any particular surprises for you or the co-authors in the findings?
So we were surprised that only 5% of patients are sent to psychiatrists for evaluation of competency. Though a law allows either of the two physicians prescribing to do so, and yet it almost never happens in Oregon. If you look at the national literature on death with dignity, the psychiatrists who write are very negative. They suggest a lot of these patients are depressed and need to be evaluated and that we're not doing it. I was also, to be honest, a little surprised to find out that the eldest patient who used this act was 102 years old, and a large fraction are greater than 90.
Really? A large, yep. Like, how big a percentage? Bigger than
I was that? Afraid you might ask me that.
dig.
So about 15% at least are older than 85.
Okay. So people well advanced in age, for sure.
That's exactly right. On the other end of the spectrum, though, the youngest patient was 25, and of course that's, you know, on the surface, very bothersome to people.
Uh-huh. Well, so I wonder, granted, you're not in the business of opinion polling here, you're a scientist, but I just wonder if this were restricted to maybe people 60-plus, 50-plus or something, if it might have been palatable to more people in the beginning.
I don't know. My worry is we would then perceive it similar to the laws in England that don't allow life-saving procedures for those older than 65, for example, restricting dialysis. I'd worry much more that people would raise the whole death panel issue if it were age-restricted.
Okay, I was just figuring out which one of us would use the term death panel first.
I guess I lose or win, whichever way you look at it.
Right, well, but yeah, given in a country where we have these kinds of discussions and they seem to hang on for years and years, it doesn't surprise me they'd be that concerned. Let's move into a broader range of discussion about SWOG, because you are the chair of SWOG, this network of physician researchers conducting cancer clinical trials. It's one of those things that used to be an acronym but isn't anymore. Is that right?
It's exactly right. It used to stand for the Southwest Oncology Group, and now we are simply SWOG.
So what do you do, and how does this study help you in your work?
So we're a 12,000-member research organization that is funded by the federal government. And historically, we've done research into cancer prevention and cancer treatment. We've actually gotten 14 drugs FDA approved for cancer usage. And we actually did a really interesting analysis that suggests we have saved more than 2 million years of human life. But now we are thinking about adding a third focus, which is end of life and palliative care issues. So, of course, this fits in quite well programmatically.
Ah, so this is a first step. You kind of check out the groundwork before you begin to make any moves ahead.
It is a first step, and you already suggested there are physicians out there who don't believe that, number one, this should be legal at all, and some who believe that we should sort of restrict the use and perhaps not even study it.
So since SWOG is an international network, I mean, there are other places in the world with death with dignity laws. I mean, have you had a chance yet to compare usage of the laws, not just what goes on in Oregon, but Oregon versus other places where it's in use?
Yeah, we absolutely did as part of this project. And again, I think the biggest difference is the fact that the other countries allow the physician to administer the lethal drug. So in general, the rates of usage are higher in countries that do that.
I get a sense that within the medical community, there's a certain level of kind of like you have to ask for this special at the ticket window kind of thing. And pardon me if this is sort of a crude analogy or metaphor, but the idea being that this is not something that's out there on the shelf, that you have to ask quietly for your physician to do this. It's not among the suite of options that's, you know, on posters on the wall. Ask your doctor about so-and-so. You know, you're not going to see physician-assisted suicide ads on television, for example.
Right.
But I just wonder if there is that level of just general sort of like, you know, if we don't talk about this, we can do it, but we're not going to have a big discussion about it publicly.
That's a great question. I mean, one of the issues, if you will, is that patients know about this, and they're asking for it more and more on their own. And so physicians need to know how it works or be willing to make the referral. That said, because they're, you know, getting this question more and more themselves, they have to be ready to do it or refer. And similarly, you already asked this question, but there is some discussion of whether this should just be one of many options that we offer up front, just so they know that it's available for them down the line when their treatment has failed or they otherwise need it.
I didn't quantify my question about, you said the last 2 years or so of this study period, and this ended in what, 2015?
Our study ended in 2015, and then there's actually another year of data that just came out in 2016.
Mm-hmm. And have you had a chance to look at that and see if the uptick that you'd noticed in those last 2 years continued?
You're the first person to ask that, and believe it or not, it actually dipped a little bit, and we don't have an explanation for that.
Okay, so we'll have a much more interesting discussion a year from now.
Probably talk
about the latest wiggle. Dr. Charles Blanke is professor of medicine at the Knight Cancer Institute at the Oregon Health and Science University, OHSU. He is also the chair of SWOG, which is a network of physician researchers conducting cancer clinical trials. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure's mine.